Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Much of the focus of today's program is education, and our first story took place on Wednesday.
All right, let's go!
Let's go!
Wright State University faculty members say they are willing to go on strike if a fair contract can't be negotiated. Several hundred teachers, represented by the American Association of University Professors, and supportive students gathered in Millett Hall for a rally before marching across campus to a scheduled community forum where Wright State President Cheryl Schrader and university trustees addressed budget concerns. Nolene McIlvena is a professor of history at Wright State. She says the administration has placed an unfair burden on its teaching professionals, putting their job security, tenure positions, and more at risk.
What has driven us to sort of contemplate striking is that this seems a full frontal attack on public education. This is not just some fight about raises. This has gone way beyond that now. And somewhere, somebody has to make a stand. And we believe the faculty of Wright State University are ready to finally say enough.
In mid-2017, Wright State announced it would have to cut more than $30 million from its budget. Then in December of last year, they announced possible furloughs for faculty. In late 2017, the AAUP amended their bylaws to allow for a possible strike. And today they say they are still frustrated by the administration's response to their concerns. Some students say they are frustrated too. Sophomore Jordan Buffington studies biological sciences and anthropology at the school.
I think the students are very supportive. I know that there's some of us that just kind of want to pretend that this isn't happening, but the other people that are really trying to stand up are really supportive and trying to be understanding to both sides. So I think it's a good group of people.
Buffington sported a badge stating, "Full-time faculty cost 17 cents of your tuition." The student explained the badge begged the question, "Where does the other 83 cents of each tuition dollar go?" That's a big question among AAUP members, including Rudy Fichtenbaum. The retired Wright State economics professor now serves as the national AAUP president. Fichtenbaum fired up the rally crowd with a speech detailing many of the sticking points that were preventing a contract agreement.
Our negotiations are not just about money. They are about power and about whether faculty will be treated as professionals, which is a necessary condition for Wright State University to remain a real university.
Fichtenbaum called the university's priorities misplaced and pointed to the school's intercollegiate athletics program, which he says was $1.8 million over budget in 2017. The union leader also stated there had been no cuts to top-level administration staff making six-figure salaries. Wright State University has so far declined to comment while contract negotiations continue. Their last proposal to the union included, among other issues, a three-year contract in which faculty would receive no raises. Teachers would also face a reduction in health benefits and higher premiums. The shutdown of the state's largest online charter school, which owes tens of millions of dollars to the state, has thousands of students searching for options in the middle of the school year. And there are also some 800 teachers and faculty from the electronic classroom of tomorrow who are now looking for work. This week, State House correspondent Karen Kassler talked to a few of them.
It's been absolutely devastating.
Sarah Aubrey is a student parent liaison and was working for ECOT from her home near Columbus.
It is really sad because the emails that I'm getting from my students that are just, they are beside themselves upset. They're basically, their whole world are being turned upside down.
Aubrey was dealing with families of ECOT students who weren't regularly attending, a key group involved in the ECOT case, which revolves around $80 million that the state says needs to be paid back for students ECOT claimed were enrolled, but their attendance could not be verified. ECOT teachers and staff know what's being said about the school, that its academic performance and graduation rate were terrible, that audits showed some kids logged in less than an hour a day and that some weren't doing any work at all, and that ECOT officials didn't care because it was all about the money. Shannon Kitchen of Mount Sterling, southwest of Columbus, became a high school intervention specialist with ECOT because she needed the flexibility as a parent of eight biological and foster children.
I get very personally offended that somebody could say that, because until you've seen what I do, I don't know how you could possibly say that ECOT hasn't put students first. And I've invited many, many people to come shadow me, come and hear these kids' stories.
These ECOT employees say while they've been following what was developing, they found out about the school's closing in real time with no advance notice. Sheila Eli-Sakarik of Green was in her third year as an eighth grade science teacher with ECOT. She says health problems will make it challenging to find a new job, especially in the middle of the school year. But she also says there's a larger impact.
You have to think of the consequences, not only for these students, but more so for the students. You know, it's going to impact taxpayers, and it's going to affect the economy with the numbers of students who won't graduate and end up being a part of our financial crisis.
Shannon Kitchen is a little more direct and emotional, saying she feels betrayed by lawmakers, state officials, and all those who pushed for ECOT to close.
If you could, they can rest at night knowing that there are 6,000 students now that won't get a diploma or won't go anywhere else, then they're better than I am because I can't rest at night. They keep me up at night thinking about my individual students that now don't have a chance to get a diploma.
And Sarah Aubrey finds some irony in ECOT's shutdown.
It kind of feels like we're the ones being bullied because a lot of our students come to ECOT because of bullying in the public schools, and now we can't even protect our students from the lawmakers that are bullying us.
ECOT claims to have 12,000 students, so there are fears of overcrowding at brick-and-mortar schools and a lack of resources at online schools as ECOT families consider what to do next. Most traditional schools have personnel set at this point in the year, and while online schools might need more teachers if ECOT students turn to them, there are limits on how much they can grow. Karen Kassler at The Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
I'm Jerry Kenney. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks again for joining us. On Christmas morning, Tyra Patterson left a Cleveland prison after serving 23 years of a life sentence. She was a Dayton teenager in 1994 when she was convicted in connection with the robbery and murder of 15-year-old Michelle Lay. Patterson said her confession to robbery was coerced. Over the years, her innocence claims garnered support, including from the murder victim's sister, and last fall, a state board granted parole. Since walking free on Christmas, Patterson has relocated to an apartment in Cincinnati. WISO's Jess Mador caught up with her there and brings us this story.
Tyra Patterson's new apartment is on the second floor of a wood frame building in downtown Cincinnati. It's a bustling corner framed by vacant and boarded buildings. She says hello from the balcony, runs down to greet a neighbor before heading back upstairs.
Welcome to my place. I always lock my door because I am a single woman living in this neighborhood. However, it's good because I live downtown, and when I start my job, I can walk to work.
When she first went away to prison, Patterson was illiterate. Early in her sentence, she learned to read and write. Eventually, she got her GED. This month, she starts her first ever professional job as a paralegal. She'll be working at her attorney's firm, the Ohio Justice and Policy Center.
I wanted to give what they have given me to others.
Well, let me show you around.
Wearing jeans, a white sweater, and a big smile, Patterson leads me on a tour around the sunny apartment.
It's actually a two-bedroom apartment. I accidentally called my apartment a two-man cell. I said a two-man, and my attorney corrected me and said two-bedroom.
This is her first apartment. Patterson is 42. There's a lot to catch up on. She spent most of her life behind bars.
It was more than half of my life, but I've always known that this day was going to come forward. I wanted to be ready, and I also knew that Holly Lay was going to come forward.
It was more than a year ago. Holly Lay Holbrook wrote a letter to Governor John Kasich asking him to release Patterson. Holbrook witnessed her sister Michelle's killing. In the letter, Holbrook told the governor Patterson did not participate in the crimes that led to her sister's death. Here's Holbrook in an interview with the Guardian newspaper.
Her being set free would set me free because I have been under all this bondage of hiding, but I am here to tell the truth and to tell the whole story. And I believe she deserves to be out of prison.
Holbrook says she and the teenagers arrested after her sister's killing were pressured by police. Patterson remembers her own interrogation. She says her robbery confession was coerced.
I was young. I was uneducated. I didn't know the tactics that the detectives used. You can actually see me being coached.
Montgomery County prosecutors have maintained there's no evidence to support Patterson or Holbrook's versions of events. Nonetheless, Patterson's hoping Governor Kasich may consider granting a pardon. Her application for clemency is pending.
It's so important to reclaim your name. What happened with Michelle was a senseless killing. And if I can change anything about that night, she would be here.
Patterson says her adjustment to life outside prison has been emotional.
We went to a gas station, and for the first time, I was able to pick out what type of juice I wanted, and I didn't know what kind I wanted. And I just broke down and I cried and I hugged, I cried, I hugged. I couldn't process it. We stayed in that gas station for a whole hour. The bigger thing that surprised me the most was seeing how awesome my brothers have become men.
She came home to find volunteers had furnished the apartment. They donated food. They took her shopping at a thrift store to buy clothing for her new job. Patterson's excited to start work. She's ready to stop depending on others for help. And she says she wants to give back. Patterson's working with criminal justice advocates on a plan for a new reentry program. It would give women the resources they need to start new lives and avoid ending up back behind bars. Patterson says she wants other women leaving prison to experience the same support she's felt since getting out.
I have been around people that I never thought would be around me. That alone has given me this boost of confidence. I know that I will be a success story because I got a job. I got somewhere to go. I have my own home. I'm going to be okay. I just wish it was so much more that we can do for others that's coming out to the same situation. And that's something that I'm going to be geared towards changing.
For now, Patterson is focusing on immediate things. She's getting settled in her new neighborhood. She's studying for her driver's test. And she's keeping up two daily habits she says kept her spirit from breaking behind bars, reading from her Bible and writing poetry in her journal. For WYSO, I'm Jess Mador.
Today on Dayton Youth Radio, we have a story from the Dayton Early College Academy by Malia Hampshire about the joy of reading.
My name is Malia Hampshire. I go to Dayton Early College Academy. I love to bake cupcakes. Trains scare me. Oh, that's a true fact. I think trains are... Actually, subways are very frightening because I don't want to get collapsed on. And I really love to read. Like, really like reading. I have an overactive imagination and sometimes I need an outlet. I needed to find something that was very productive. My story is about escaping reality through books. I believe that most people, teens and adults, take reading for granted. I feel that they don't give books a chance to show them a whole new world of fantasy and magic. One time I asked my twin sister, what if the gingerbread man didn't run away? Instead, he terrorized the residents on Drury Lane until they had to resort to eating the gingerbread man to stop the attacks. Alright. I started reading books seriously when I was 5. During the summer, my sisters and I went to daycare, and the caretaker, Miss Carmen, a 5'5" black woman who wore jeans and sometimes nurse shirts, had us do a lot of stuff. She would teach us the alphabet and how to count. She taught us how to write. And sometimes she would take us out on field trips to museums, aquariums. She even took us to the movies. She was a great person. One day, she decided to take everyone to the library. When we got there, she gave us a book and told us, "You will not get up unless you finish this book." So I read my first book, and when I was done, Miss Carmen would say, "Get up and find another book." When Dad came to pick us up, I wanted to finish the book. So he had all three of us register to get a library card.
Hello, I'm here interviewing my father. His name is...
Lynn Hampshire.
Well, hello.
Hello.
When we were younger and we read often, how did it make you feel?
Proud, because you guys started reading early, and it was better for me to see reading instead of sitting in front of television. And it didn't bother us to go to the library and you guys picked up 20, 30 books. I remember there was a time where you and your sister was upstairs, you were reading, and I didn't hear a noise. That worried me because I didn't hear a noise. And I came upstairs to check, and it was like, you were on one couch, she was on the other. I said, you guys okay? He was like, yeah, we're fine. I'm like, okay, just checking.
I'm here talking to my mother today. Hello, what's your name?
My name is Takiya Hampshire.
What made you start reading books more after you were growing up?
Well, there's this book called Slave Girl. It's a story about a young slave girl growing up in slavery times from youth to adolescence and how she escaped from slavery.
Did you really like this book?
I enjoyed it because at that time I was in the fifth grade being bused to a new school. And at that time in the 70s, busing was controversial. And I came up against some picketing and heckling, and the first time I came up head-to-head with racism.
All right. What would you say your advice to other parents who's trying to get their kids to read?
How I got my children to read was reading out loud to them. I picked Dr. Seuss. Also got some African fairy tales in there, and that's what I want for all of my children. See different aspects through reading, even though I want them to go out and see the world.
Well, thank you, Mom, for giving me Molina the love of books.
The thing about reading is that people think that it's a chore, and it's not. At schools, and sometimes by teachers, want you to overanalyze the story. Teachers don't tell students that they are in the shoes of the main characters. But when I read, I see what they see. I feel what they feel. I get to be the character. I get to fight for freedom. For Damn Youth Radio at DECA, this is Malia Hampshire.
That's a story entitled Bookends, written and produced by Malia Hampshire, a student at the Dayton Early College Academy. Special thanks to Malia's parents, Lynn and Takiya Hampshire, and Ann Rasmussen at DECA. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. Well, from reading to speaking, education is obviously the main focus of any educational institution, and Wilmington College's upcoming speaker series will not only educate, but tie historical perspectives to current events. To find out more about the series, I spoke with Tanya Moss, director of the Peace Resource Center and Quaker Heritage Center at Wilmington, and Ursula McTaggart, an associate professor of English there. First, Moss tells us more about the Heritage Center and the impact of the speaker series.
Wilmington College, for people who don't know much about our campus, is a Quaker college that goes back to 1870, and so we've had a legacy and continue to be devoted to social justice and peacemaking according to the Quaker peace testimony. This series came about because when I put a call out for programming, about 7 or 8 faculty came forward and said that they were working on issues of abolitionism and slavery on campus, so we decided collaboratively to do a series this spring.
This is not altogether different than any normal programming that you might come up with, but obviously faculty members felt this was certainly an important time for some of these discussions.
Absolutely. Even today, as we were talking about this interview, Professor McTaggart and I were discussing the resonance with current issues involved with the Women's March on Washington, D.C., Black Lives Matters, and some of the dialogues that are currently taking place between feminists who are grappling with the challenges of a mass movement seeking to create political change.
How long have you had the speaker series, and what kind of impact do you feel that your guests have made on their audiences over the years?
Well, the Quaker Heritage Center is a museum. Its mission is to educate the campus and local and regional communities about a heritage of Quaker history through artifacts and various exhibits. We're actually the only gallery in the United States fully devoted to Quaker heritage and its exhibition. The speaker series we do occasionally, often combined with our exhibits. This spring it'll be a speaker series only. And the community that comes are Quakers in the area who are seeking to connect with their Quaker beliefs and values, social justice advocates, people who are engaged in peace activism or other social activism tend to come out. We also have a lot of folks who are interested in history. Last semester we had a series about the Marshall Plan and U.S. foreign relief in Western Europe after World War II, and then we had some folks from the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base come out because of that interest. So we get an eclectic mix of folks who come to these events, as well as our student body.
Let's talk about student response to this. How do they feel about past speaker series and this one coming up?
When our speaker series touch on issues that are immediately relevant to our students' lives, they're incredibly engaged. We've had students engage in discussion and dialogue. We've had student panels sometimes as part of our programming in which we work with speakers together and talk with their various peer groups on campus. And so we typically, at events like this, about 60 to 70% sometimes will be students on our campus. Wilmington College students come from local communities with usually within a 50 to 75 mile range of the college. We get some students from across the country, but many of them are from Southwest Ohio. They're a very devoted, hardworking group of students, and these kinds of series are intended to engage them more deeply in the social issues that they confront today, but also through the lens of history and Quaker heritage.
And Ursula, thank you as well for speaking with us today. Let's talk a little bit about the details in this speaker series.
Yes. A big part of my interest as an academic and as a teacher is thinking about how art, I'm an English teacher, so I usually focus on literature, but all kinds of art can be used to bring about social change, the impact of music and impact of literature on social change with connection to the Harriet Beecher Stowe House. And my colleague Laura Struve and I are teaching a class titled Literature That Sparks Social Change, where we're interested in thinking about a work of art that actually does seem to impact something in the real world.
And can you give our listeners just one example of where literature has had that impact?
Well, we're starting with Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, which has historically been credited with dramatically changing the cultural views of slavery in the 1850s. And we think that it really did perform a function. And we're interested in thinking about the challenges of a social movement in the sense that there's all kinds of conflict about how best to bring about change. So a lot of our discussion is not just celebrating this work, but thinking about how in a culture that embraced those stereotypes, it was that work of art that ended up having an impact, whereas there were a lot of slave narratives out there written by Frederick Douglass, William Wells Brown, and many others who did not use stereotypes, and they certainly had an impact, but the culture at large responded to Stowe's work perhaps more dramatically than they did to the slave narratives. So we see that not necessarily as something to celebrate, but why was it that Stowe's work, with all of its problems, was also something that had some positive impacts for the abolitionist movement?
A perfect example, since that is the subject of your first presentation on Thursday, February 1st. Let's talk about some of the other highlights within this series, which will take place in February and March.
Absolutely. I think that Dr. Tamika Nunley from Oberlin will also address some of this conflict about interracial abolitionism in antebellum Washington, D.C. You know, interracial abolitionism was not a smooth and easy process. So Harriet Beecher Stowe was writing an abolitionist work with Uncle Tom's Cabin, but she wasn't very much enmeshed in the activist form of abolitionism at that time. She was a writer. She was a middle-class woman. She became very famous for her work, and abolitionists began to reach out to her. Frederick Douglass for instance, reached out to her after she became famous for Uncle Tom's Cabin. He requested that she contribute money for a school for former slaves. She declined to participate in that. Harriet Jacobs, another famous former slave who wrote her own slave narrative, asked for some funding help from Harriet Beecher Stowe. Again, she wasn't interested in providing that, and she wasn't interested in being a part of the American Anti-Slavery Society or attending its gatherings, though she was invited to do so because she had problems with the fact that they didn't share her fundamental commitment to Christianity. So she produced a work that had a great impact, but it wasn't necessarily part, it didn't indicate that she was part of this larger movement. Certainly, throughout abolitionist history, there were all kinds of other conflicts that went on, disputes over what were the best strategies, and some of those broke down along racial lines, and others did not.
And, of course, this series will look at a lot of that history of African Americans, again, the abolitionists and Quakers. And, again, it looks like a fascinating series. Where can our listeners find out more information about some of the speakers and some of the music that will be the focus of this series?
Yes, they can find out more about it on the Wilmington College Quaker Heritage Center website at wilmington.edu.
Ursula McTaggart is Associate Professor of English at Wilmington College, and Tanya Moss is Director of the Peace Resource Center and Quaker Heritage Center. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thanks.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. For the first week of late winter and the second week of the frolicking fox moon and the first full week of the sun in Aquarius. Sometimes the arrival of late winter carries a great thaw. One day I went out to the river in the warmth of such a thaw, when cumulus clouds tumbled across the sky in gusts of the southwest wind, and the water of the river was shining with low, brisk waves of silvers and blues and grays. The oaks of the far bank were black against the bright sky. On hillsides of Osage trees, patches of their yellow wood glowed like the flush of expanding spring buds. And below the Osage, hardy green chickweed and wild onion and garlic mustard and henbit and hemlock lay akimbo across the melting snow. The river had flooded earlier in the week. Mounds and drifts of silt and sand followed the course of the flood along the paths. In the bottomland, the high water had uncovered foliage of buttercups and ragwort and sweet rockets. In the swamp, fat skunk cabbage curled above the mud, many plants open and blooming. Great white stalks of last May's angelica crunched under my feet as I picked my way across the wetland. The rivulets that passed through the grassy bogs were full and fast. I even saw small fingerlings swimming in one stream far from any pool for safe haven. I surprised a water strider in an eddy of a brook watercress and duckweed there. Climbing to the top of the ridge, I saw the river and its tributaries become paths of radiance. And sometimes, as I walked into a sudden patch of fog, the brilliant curves of life disappeared, the enclosure of the enveloping fog showing both the confinement and the freedom of the valley. There I lost my landmarks, but also my limits. There was no other side to the river, and like the end of the year before me, the opposite bank seemed infinitely distant. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the second week of late winter. In the meantime, walk in the thaws and in the promise of their season. Poor Will's Almanac for 2018 is available from Amazon. And you can purchase my book, Home is the Prime Meridian, Essays on Time and Place and Spirit, from the same site. The collection contains a number of the selections heard on this radio segment.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.